Today's video is brought to you by Audible. Now, if there's something that I've started to do more and more when it comes to making videos online, it's that I've started to make more of an effort to write the script for my video in a way that you don't miss any key details just by listening. And based on this poll I did a while back, about 69% of you prefer to listen to videos over watching them. And if you're someone who likes consuming content in this way, then you'll probably like today's sponsor, Audible, the go-to service when it comes to audiobooks. With the Audible Plus catalog containing thousands of audiobooks, exclusive Audible original titles, and podcasts on a number of subjects, Audible has not only made housework a heck of a lot more entertaining, but Audible has also helped me research the videos I do for this channel. Just off the top of my head, a few titles that I'm a fan of or I've used in part for research include Nick Bilton's American Kingpin, which I've recommended a couple times. I also used The Book of Satoshi. I also used Final Destination Disaster in regards to Flight 980. The Darkest Web was one of the sources I used for the Base of Mafia video, and the title Underground was useful for getting a background on Shinrikyo when I did the whole VHS video. With all of that being said, try Audible absolutely free for 30 days by going to audible.com/sociable or texting sociable to 500-500. Once again, that's audible.com/sociable or text sociable to 500-500. And thanks once again to Audible for making this video possible. The following excerpt was written by Harold William Tillman, a legendary explorer who led an expedition to Heard Island in 1964. Heard Island, in latitude 53 degrees 10 minutes south, longitude 73 degrees 35 minutes east, is an uninhabited subantarctic island lying about 300 miles to the southeast of the much larger island Kerguelen. Measuring only some 23 miles by 12 miles, it culminates in the peak known as Big Ben, which is 9,005 feet high. Thus, the island is nearly all mountain, a mountain heavily glaciated on all sides. Many of the glaciers terminate in ice cliffs that are washed by the sea. As far back as 1957, I had an eye to Big Ben, but inquiries shown that there was no safe anchorage where mischief could be left. A letter, too, from Mr. P.G. Law, then and now director of the Australian Antarctic Division, had been discouraging. As regards your getting to Heard Island, he had written, "I cannot overstress the dangers which will face you if you proceed in a small boat. As you know, Heard Island is right in the track of the great westerly cyclones, which sweep across the Southern Ocean, with almost no intervening period of good weather of any duration. The seas are mountainous, and altogether, I can think of no worse place to sail a small craft." Now, Tillman would captain a ship called the Patinella for this particular expedition. While Mischief was his usual ship, he didn't dare take it to this place. And due to his efforts, they were later successful in reaching the summit of this remote and desolate place. As a result of this being the first time that Big Ben had been summited, it was an achievement heard across the globe. But what nobody knew at the time was that Tillman would later disappear at sea some 13 years later, with not a trace of him being found since. At the age of 79, he had been attempting to lead a similar world-first expedition to Mount Foster in the Antarctic. But after the ship had left port in Rio de Janeiro, what followed was an eerie silence, as the man who had spent his entire life cheating death had seemingly finally had his time. Between fighting in both world wars, including the First Battle of Somme, and earning medals for bravery each time, to setting world records for exploration and mountain climbing, until he eventually became a world-class celestial navigator. And it's safe to say Harold William Tillman was truly an extraordinary man with a death wish. While you might wonder what would drive a man to spend the entirety of his life on these types of excursions, in a few remarks about the war after the fact, he stated that he was often questioning why he was the one who had survived. And as a result of not wanting to be left alone with his thoughts, he could never fully adjust to a mundane life. As a result, this led to Tillman being a part of some of the earliest recon trips to the Himalayas for mountaineering. And for a time, he even held the world record for the tallest mountain summited, that being Nanda Devi in the 1930s. Additionally, he is even responsible for scouting the route that would later become the standard approach for Everest. And that all being said, the Mount Heard expedition was just a final footnote on his extensive list of achievements. And had it not been for the Patinella, this world achievement would have likely never occurred. Because even for a man as fearless as Tillman, even he knew better than to take his ship Mischief on the journey. And when he asked if Patanella was a worthy vessel, he immediately reconsidered. For just like Harold Tillman had cheated death, the Patanella had also gained a reputation for cheating death as well. In 1954, the vessel had also been used for crayfishing, and on one particular day, the boat got into a bit of trouble and ended up gashing a major hole in its hull. Now, this boat had been equipped with a watertight bulkhead, which in turn managed to confine the water to only a certain part of the hull, preventing it from sinking. Miraculously, the boat had managed to make it back to the port unaided after spending 14 hours at sea. As a result, the Patanella had gained a reputation as an incredibly durable 63-foot steel-hulled ship that would be chartered for multiple voyages to all parts of the globe. Thus, this ended up making the Patanella a piece of history, not only for this world first, but also in Harold Tillman's often-forgotten legacy. But unbeknownst to everyone at the time, the Patanella would later come to have another thing in common with Harold Tillman over 24 years later. Now, as time would progress, the Patanella would seemingly not be able to continue a mundane life either, as the boat had continued to pop up in newspapers over the years. In the 1970s, a man by the name of Norm Hunt had his own set of adventures with the Patanella, where, in a around-the-world journey, he had eventually been iced in at Greenland Harbor. After spending days dodging icebergs, they eventually made it out unscathed. Additionally, on another voyage to Kenya during this time, the ship had been left unattended for less than half of an hour. After they returned back to the ship, they had found that the ship had been ransacked. And while it's definitely surprising just how many times this tiny ship had made headlines, we're really only getting started going into the 80s. Because that's when the story of the Patanella would really take a bizarre turn. That being in 1988, when after being passed down from owner to owner, the ship had eventually been purchased by a wealthy businessman from Perth by the name of Alan Nicol. At the time, the ship was valued at about $500,000. And after being purchased, this is when Patanella's final known journey would begin. On the 16th of October, 1988, the goal was a month-long voyage, where they were to set out from Fremantle Harbor for Airlie Beach in Australia, where Nicol planned to vacation in the Whitsundays with his wife and their two children. The boat was also scheduled to work as a charter vessel thereafter. As the journey began, the boat had a crew of six. On board was the schooner's owner, who we already discussed, his skipper, Ken Jones, a 52-year-old distinguished sailor, his wife, Noreen Jones, their daughter, Rona Lee Jones, and two young sailors, 23-year-old John Blissett and 21-year-old Michael Calvin. Blissett and Calvin were new to the boat, and they first started working for Alan after they both struck up a conversation with him at Fremantle before the journey started. Both of the young men explained that they were looking to gain sailing hours that they could add towards their navigational certificates. Additionally, they agreed that they could work as crewmen for the boat's charter business when they arrived at Airlie Beach. As a result, Nicol hired them. And as the first portion of the journey began, it was all smooth sailing. But on October 29th, both Rona Lee Jones and Alan Nicol had got off the boat at Port Lincoln for other work-related commitments. This was only temporary for Alan, though, and he planned on getting back on the boat in Sydney on November 8th, where he would get back on the boat and continue to Airlie Beach to meet his family. But little did Alan and Rona Lee know that at the time they were getting off the boat at Port Lincoln, it would be the last time they saw Patanella ever again. As a result, this left four people on board: Ken Jones, his wife Noreen, and the two new crewmen, John Blissett and Michael Calvin. A few days after Alan was dropped off, on November 4th, Alan received a radio call from his skipper, who claimed the boat was docked in Portland. and that they needed money for fuel. While the money was later wired to Ken, he later withdrew it, but it's unclear if he actually purchased fuel that day. The next day, on November 5th, Michael Calvin's father had received a surprise call from his son. On the line, he said, "Good day, Dad." But after this, the line went dead. On that same day, Jones radioed Wilson's promontory, where he gave a positional update. He would do the same thing on November 6th as they passed Vega. On November 7th, Patinella was spotted by a lighthouse keeper at Point Perpendicular. And as the sun set on the 7th and led into the 8th, at 1 a.m., a radio operator at Overseas Telecommunication Commission received a call from Ken Jones. He stated that Patinella was currently 10 nautical miles east from Botany Bay in Sydney. He would go on to say, "I believe we've run out of fuel. We've hoisted our sails, and we're tacking out to the east, tacking out about 080. Our intention is to tack out for a couple hours, then tack back in. We may need some assistance in the morning to get back into Sydney Harbor." Now, this transmission was noted to be odd by the family members for a couple of reasons. For one, Ken Jones' son had this to say after he listened to it. "It's certainly my father's voice in the tape, but it doesn't seem to be his words. I don't think he'd ever say he believed that he was out of fuel. He was too experienced to be so vague. I think his radio calls were veiled calls for help." Additionally, Alan Nicol stated that the Patinella would not have been short of fuel, as the 3,500-liter fuel tanks were filled to capacity at the start of the voyage, and additional diesel had been added at stops along the way. But the oddities don't end there. About an hour later, Ken called back and requested directions to the town of Maruya, which was 300 kilometers south. The operator provided the directions, but Ken soon called back again a few minutes later. This time, there was a lot of static on the line, and the only words that could be deciphered were 300 kilometers south? Is it south? This would be the last known communication from Patinella. Assuming they ran into trouble at night while sailing, it's worth pointing out that the boat had been equipped with an emergency position indicating radio beacon. Had some issue occurred on board, they would have been able to send a distress frequency to any passing aircraft overhead for 48 hours. Now, these beacons can either be activated manually or automatically if submerged in water, but no such signal seems to have been sent. Despite Ken failing to arrive at Sydney the next morning, on the 8th, Nicol didn't report the boat missing. But I should clarify that he did not know about the transmission from the night before. And whatever reasoning Ken had for asking for directions to Maruya, that remains unclear. After the Patinella's last correspondence, it wouldn't be until 11 days later that the boat was actually reported missing. That was when the Patinella had failed to reach Airlie Beach on the 18th. At that time, Peter Jones, the son of the skipper, attempted to reach his father on that day. After multiple attempts to reach his father, he subsequently went to the authorities. But the authorities refused to launch a full-scale search. The Patinella case was plunged into controversy when the Federal Sea Safety and Surveillance Center in Canberra refused to launch a full-scale search for the yacht. The center said it had been notified 11 days after the yacht went missing, and that any proper search would have to cover an impossible 200,000 square kilometers of ocean. Now, after a three-year investigation from the Australian government, they later declared in 1992 that the boat had simply sunk on that same night that they radioed into Botany Bay. Now, despite this conclusion, they never elaborate on how the boat sank, leaving that up to interpretation. While the weather definitely wasn't a factor, as the weather was calm that night when the boat disappeared, the investigation instead proposed that the boat was hit by another large freighter, and not reported for some reason. This was despite all other 48 vessels in the area that night having been checked for damage to their hull. None of them showed any damage. And it's worth mentioning that the boat was spotted multiple times after this night. Now, the investigation went on to claim that none of these sightings were ever confirmed. But that being said, some 6 months after the boat had disappeared, on May 9th of 1989, fishermen off the coast of Terrigal, about 30 miles north of Sydney, discovered a barnacle-covered buoy. After the fisherman retrieved it out of the water, he he found that it bore the name Patinella. Now, this buoy was later sent to Sydney University for testing. Marine biologists there concluded that the buoy's growth of barnacles had determined that the buoy had been drifting for no more than 4 weeks, suggesting that the boat was still afloat some months later. But in various other retellings of the stories by officials working on this case, they disregard the one-month claim and state the following. A life buoy identified as being from the Patinella was recovered from the Sea of Terrigal, New South Wales, on the 9th of May, 1989. Marine growth adhering to the life buoy suggested that it may have been in the water for a considerable time, possibly 6 months. Now, there was some debate over this evidence in the investigation, predominantly on the note of the fisherman who had retrieved it out of the water, as he had rinsed off a portion of it to read the word Patinella. But based on the statements made in news reports at the time, marine biologists were also able to determine that the specific type of marine life found present on the life ring was specific to the Coral Sea, where they speculated that the life ring had drifted from a point near Cooktown, Australia. On top of that, the boat had been spotted at Rockingham Bay in March and at Fraser Island on June 9th. And interestingly enough, on June 3rd, an unidentified body had been found washed up on Manly Beach, 25 miles from where the buoy was found. The body that washed up on Manly Beach was 175 to 180 centimeters tall. It was believed to be a man between the ages of 20 and 30. However, the body had been so badly decomposed that the person was completely unidentifiable. Additionally, the man was believed to have had a slim build, and when they found him, he only had one leg remaining, with one of his shoes being a shoal size 9. While the police gave a rough estimate of him being at sea for about 4 weeks, keep in mind this is a rough approximation. Because when it comes to estimating a body's decomposition at sea, that's not something that we generally have a lot of data on. And there are a lot of variables when it comes to this process occurring at sea, such as water temperature, animal activity, and other studies have even pointed to things like water oxygen levels being a factor. And to elaborate a bit further on what I'm talking about here, one obvious variable that needs to be factored in is ocean scavengers. Things like sharks, crabs, and small fish will tend to pick apart a body pretty quickly. Depending on the animal activity, there can be a pretty drastic variance in a body's decomposition. And just recently, in another study on body decomposition, scientists found that scavengers would have selective preferences on bodies depending on the dissolved oxygen levels in the water. Additionally, another thing that is very common in bodies retrieved from shipwrecks or diving accidents and other maritime incidents is this thing called adipocere or grave wax. Essentially, adipocere is an incredibly persistent substance that forms from the decomposition of fat cells, ultimately leading to a preservational effect on the body. For example, in 2011, after a couple nearby earthquakes in Switzerland, a body was found floating in Lake Brienz. The investigation estimated that the body was as fresh as 6 months old, but as it turned out, adipocere ended up creating a massive cocoon on the torso of the body, and x-rays later showed that it preserved much of the internal portions of the man, including his heart, stomach, and other structures. They later examined cherry pits found in his stomach, as well as some bone collagen from the cadaver. After further analysis, radiocarbon dating placed the man's death at 300 years. But that being said, adipocere's development isn't fully understood. And to quote this paper from the Journal of Forensic and Legal Medicine, while several studies have been performed on the nature, the formation, and the degradation of adipocere, there's still no reliable model to assess the post-mortem interval of a body exhibiting it. But to put it simply, the ocean is still a mystery in many ways, and it's difficult to take this four-week figure at face value without any kind of reasoning. Given this detail, who's to say that it wasn't 7 weeks to match the time frame of the buoy, or 7 months to match the night the Patinella disappeared? We truly don't know. But that being said, when push came to shove, this body seemed to line up closest with one of the missing crew members, Michael Calvin, and as such, police requested his dental records. Presumably, it wasn't a match, though. I say presumably because there seems to be no further statement given on the matter. And besides a couple articles in local newspapers at the time, there isn't a single mention of this body in any other literature on this case. And when I say there's not a single mention of this body later on, not in regards to this case or any other case either. Searching for further information about a body that washed up at this particular location and time only ever yields these details. And given the findings of the marine biologists and the sightings that placed the Patinella in the area, all of these details seem to suggest that the Patinella was still afloat, perhaps hijacked with a new crew. Considering the aforementioned and assuming the two things were connected, it seems that one theory that could be proposed here was that there was some other emergency on the Patinella, ultimately leading to the deployment of the life buoy. One thing that seems to suggest this was a statement given by Alan Nicol at the time. When asked about the life ring, he stated that this wasn't just some object that would have fallen off the boat. It was located in a position that required manual detachment. But all that being said, there's also a chance that this body is perhaps related to something else entirely. But as far as the official record goes, whoever washed up on Manly Beach June 3rd, 1989, that remains unknown. As the investigation continued, more and more sightings continued to occur across the globe, with the most common being along the Australian coast. Additionally, several other sightings were reported around Thailand and Southeast Asia, and one sighting even made it as far as South America. And all things considered, despite no distress signal being sent from the Patinella, with no debris of any kind being found, with no damage to any other boats in the area, the Australian investigation still concluded that the boat had to have sank on the same night in Botany Bay. And not only did they conclude this with a lack of evidence, they concluded this while dismissing other valid evidence at the time. Instead of addressing the marine biologist's findings, they were later misrepresented at a later date without any kind of clarification. And don't even get me started on that body, which is such an obscure detail, it is yet to reach the light of day in any other discussion of this case. To put it simply, you'd think that if they were so certain the Patinella had sunk on the same night without any kind of hijacking or other crime taking place, the Australian investigation could prove it by searching a very specific area 10 miles off the coastline. But as far as I'm aware, no attempt was made to prove the investigation's theory. And to put it simply, the hit-and-run theory they proposed was a stretch, and I haven't even brought up the fact that the Patinella had received $40,000 worth of upgrades after going under new ownership. Included in those upgrades was a new radar system that would alert them to any nearby vessels, which would have made it next to impossible that they could have been a victim of a hit and run. Even if we factor in any kind of other disaster occurring on that same night, the fact that no debris was found the next morning leaves you with no reason to believe the boat had sank the night before. So all in all, a highly durable ship capable of sailing to any place on the planet, known for facing some of the world's toughest conditions, persevering through icebergs for days on end, that had just been upgraded with some of the best navigation and safety equipment money could buy, simply sank without any evidence, and the case was closed, according to the professionals. Naturally, you have to ask what the hell was going on with this investigation. And to take a closer look at how the investigation ran its course, let's begin with Alan Nicol's actions after the Patinella disappeared. If you recall, Mr. Alan Nicol never reported the boat missing. This detail is incredibly strange. Alan was due to be picked up on the 8th. But for some reason, he presumed that they had continued on without him. Despite some 11 days passing with no further correspondence, this still wasn't enough for him to say anything. And this makes it appear that perhaps some factor was preventing Nicol from going to the authorities. It's possible, but it's also possible that Nicol was also distracted by his day-to-day. Regardless of the strange detail, Nicol definitely seemed concerned about the boat's disappearance, and he seems to have been very proactive in the search for the boat. Because in the following months, he went on to spend some $30,000, where he basically financed his own investigation and went to great lengths to interview people who had seen the ship. And most notably, after the Patinella had disappeared, he had made several allegations to Western Australian police. To start his list of suspicions, he suspected the skipper to have played some role in hijacking the boat, based on previous business failures. But no further elaboration is given on this detail in later reports. The only thing that does even slightly seem to suggest this possibility was the final transmission. Ken Jones randomly asking for directions to Maruya, that does definitely seem to point to some suspicious behavior. But it's also plausible that Ken could have been acting under duress, and like Ken Jones' son said, perhaps his final conversation was in fact a thinly veiled call for help. Now, perhaps the most bizarre allegation by Nickel was that he suggested that the previous owners of the boat were aggrieved of its sale, and plotted to get the boat back. He claimed that he was ripped off. And while the police investigated this point, I couldn't find any other details that would corroborate this at all. Getting back to the crew, though, further allegations were made at John Blissett and Michael Calvin. This one seemed to be a bit more plausible, though. In hindsight, he didn't know them very well. They were the only variable for this trip, and it also seemed suspicious that the two boys apparently admired the Pantanella so much, it led them to ask for a job on the boat. At the time this case was being investigated, it definitely seemed plausible. But some two decades later, on New Year's Day 2008, a woman combing a secluded beach near the town of Eucla had found a message in a bottle from John Blissett. It was dated October 26th, 1988. It read, "Hi there, out there on the lonely Southern Ocean, and thought we would give away a free holiday in the Whitsunday Islands in North Queensland, Australia. Our ship is traveling from Fremantle, Western Australia, to Queensland to work as a charter vessel. It gave the Pantanella's position as 34 degrees, 24 minutes, 20 seconds south, 129 degrees, 18 minutes, 54 seconds east. Additionally, it included a number for people to call to claim their prize, and he signed off saying, see you soon, Jono." Now, ultimately, this note seems to suggest that the two boys were interested in going on an adventure, as this entire thing seems incredibly lighthearted. Presuming that they planned on doing something malicious in the coming days, this seems completely out of character. Now, moving on to the final allegation made by Nickel. That was that he suspected that the boat was hijacked by persons involved with trafficking narcotics. Based on his own investigation, which led him to interviewing various people who had spotted the ship, he had learned that the boat wouldn't stop into town for fuel or supplies. The ship was almost exclusively spotted around open water, and on the rare occasion that Pantanella did dock into shore, it would only go to remote areas that were accessible by four-wheel drive vehicles. If we consider the strange behavior from Ken that night, with no emergency transmission, along with the later sightings of the boat placing it in Thailand, this theory, while reliant on eyewitness testimony, does seem to have some plausibility. While it is worth noting that eyewitness testimony is notoriously unreliable, the Pantanella was a pretty distinct ship given its older design. Assuming the sightings around Thailand were true, this would have placed the boat along a known trafficking route out of the Golden Triangle. Additionally, had this been the case, this could also account for the buoy drifting from some remote part in the Coral Sea. Additionally, the boat would have been refitted to disguise its look and then re-registered in a different country by bribing separate officials. On top of all of that, given the nature of what business we would be potentially dealing with this case, this can also account for some potential corruption in the investigation, which could explain the poor conclusion given by the investigation. But getting back to that investigation, let's take another look at how that all went down. Because after Nickel raised suspicions about a further crime and reported his allegations, from here, there was apparently some internal struggle over who was responsible for the case, and as a result of bureaucratic issues, no work was done on this case for months. The investigation was later escalated from the Federal Sea Safety Center in Canberra to the Australian Federal Police, and in February of 1989, they finally assigned Detective Superintendent Ed Tyree to be in charge of the case, with him being an advisor to who had the final say in the case, that being the state coroner, Derek Hand. Now, in Australia, the coroner's role is a bit different. It's not a medical position. Instead, it's an appointed judicial officer with the legal job to investigate the cause of deaths reported to them. And it just so happens that this isn't the only questionable conclusion given by Mr. Derek Hand. And just recently, in 2019, the Australian police announced that they would be reopening one of his cases from this time. A case that has some similar circumstances to what we're talking about. That being the case of Robbie Joe Coulter, a 17-year-old teen who lived in Mildura. After Robbie had left a New Year's party in the early hours of the morning, he had last been seen walking along the side of a road. He never made it back that night. 2 days later, on January 3rd, 1989, Robbie's body would be found in a nearby river. His body had been weighed down with 21-kilogram mill bricks. His hands were found bound behind his back with bolts to secure them. According to local news reports at the time, Robbie Joe's family suspected he had been a victim of a mafia-style drug-related execution. And stepfather Linton Coulter revealed Robbie Joe had told him he feared narcotics dealers were out to get him after he had witnessed a drug drop 2 months earlier. Do you want to know what Derek Hand had to say about this particular case? He stated that he was, quote, quite satisfied that Coulter was not murdered. To add insult to injury, Mr. Derek Hand ruled that Robbie had taken his own life instead. Another unpopular theory, with one publication stating, the coroner made an open finding, nobody, not least his mother and stepfather, agreed. And additionally, this would call into question the entirety of the police working alongside Mr. Derek Hand, as the police instead discredited the elephant in the room and insisted that there was some practical joke that could have gone wrong. Once again, they had no evidence to suggest this. Reportedly, the party was not a wild one. Robbie wasn't intoxicated, and additionally, it appeared that Robbie had made it back to his apartment thereafter. I should go on to state Robbie's family has been waiting 30 years for answers on this particular case. They had been asking every single year for the case to be reopened. And all that being considered, the same person who was responsible for this case is the same person who had the final say in the Patinella case. Now, it just so happens that Ed Tyree later found nothing and claimed these allegations made by Nickel were without apparent substance. He would later go on to give the statement, inquiries into various allegations insinuating that Patinella was afloat and involved in criminal activities are unable to be substantiated. This idea was discredited so much by Tyree's investigation that they seemed to fire accusations back at Nickel. And I kid you not, they went as far as to suggest that he had reported criminal suspicions as a way of dealing with, quote, perceived inactivity on the part of various agencies, both Commonwealth and state, to search for the Patinella. Now, ultimately, Ed Tyree and Derek Hand's investigation led to this hit-and-run theory, which makes absolutely no sense. But I should mention that not all of the members of the AFP had the same opinions. And when the life buoy was found, another detective superintendent by the name of Dave Lewington of the AFP, National Criminal Investigation Branch, he went on to say the buoy supported the theory that a crime had been committed on the boat. He cited the findings of the marine biologists and a recent oceanographic report, which had confirmed to him that prevailing currents at the time meant the life ring had to have floated from somewhere in the Coral Sea, not the Tasman Sea. And perhaps the most jarring thing about this investigation was the absolute slap in the face to the families after the fact. The detective working on this case was commended on his work in this investigation by the state coroner, Mr. Derek Hand. Think about that for a second. Derek Hand complimented his detective on finding nothing. Now, if I had to summarize this case, nearly every detail given in news reports at the time seems to conflict with the final statements given by the officials in charge of the investigation. And if you're wondering where I got these final statements, these all come from the Australian Federal Police's own publication in an article on the Patinella. While you might expect the most detail to come from an article written by the actual investigation, it was actually the least helpful and perhaps the most vague in regards to this case. And based on referencing every little piece of literature I could find on this case, it portrays a pretty dark and disturbing story. Neither Australian entity bothered to search for the boat after four people disappeared. Additionally, their reluctance continued after multiple sightings were made. The investigation never attempted to prove the boat's final resting place, despite claiming it was only 10 miles offshore from a major city. The investigation's conclusion contradicts multiple pieces of scientific evidence without any clarification, so much so that comments by their peers at the time have blatant contradictions. The investigation accused a victim of making false accusations, claiming he didn't actually believe them. But from other sources, we learn he spent $30,000 of his own money to search for the boat. The investigation claimed that every single sighting of the world-famous bright yellow ship was not verifiable. But when you dig up some of the news reports at the time, the sightings not only match certain time frames of other key details, They also seem to have a specific behavior, as Nickel noted. And perhaps the most interesting discrepancy was that the investigation had Michael Calvin's dental records tested on a body that washed up within close proximity and time frame to the only known piece of Pathanella. While one police spokesman stated that nothing had indicated that it could have been a crewman from Pathanella, their actions were completely contradictory, as it was reported that they had requested these specific records only. And with the results due in subsequent days, there was no further statement on this matter. Furthermore, it only makes sense in a situation where two corrupt individuals are conspiring together that a coroner would praise a detective for being so persistent at finding nothing. Questionable investigation aside though, wherever the Pathanella is today, or what exactly happened to the crew, they are both still mysteries. And ultimately, we're left with more questions than answers. This is Barely Sociable. Have a good day.